Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a True Cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate True Cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade-in for your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
All right, everybody. Hey, it's Todd. I'm still in production in Vancouver. This episode was actually recorded on a Sunday in the middle of one of our marketing shoot days. So we were took a little bit of chunk out of time so that I could talk to my guest this week. His name is Andy Fickman, and he is the director of this movie that we're shooting up here called Playing with Fire. This week, Andy won the prestigious What's on Stage Award for Best Actress and Best New Musical for his movie Heathers in London, which he directed, and which was produced by Lord Andrew Lloyd Webber. And guess what? We didn't even talk about that because we were pretty delirious on a Sunday. I think I was on 3 hours of sleep. We didn't even actually get to Andy's theater experience very much, but he is no stranger to the theater experience. He's having directed and produced the Reefer Madness musical, Zootopia in Los Angeles, and Heathers in L.A. and off-Broadway. We didn't really talk about theater that much. What we did talk about was making family movies, why he and I love making them, why we think they do so well at the box office, why the critics don't seem to love them very much. We talked about his time working for Gene Wilder and Bette Midler, and we spent an inordinate amount of time talking about the time he was the court jester in the Texas Renaissance Festival in Magnolia, Texas. I hope this makes sense because we were pretty out of it. Enjoy. All right, I'm here with Andy Fickman. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Todd.
And we are on set of our movie, Playing with Fire.
Playing with Fire.
In Vancouver. And so we're sitting in your office, which I will take a picture of because people won't believe it, because it definitely looks like an episode of Hoarders. And this is what you do.
It's not a hoarding problem. It's more like if there was a show called Way Cool Collectibles that might be with hoarders. That's the difference, Todd.
But to describe it, and I will definitely put a picture of it up. You have all of the inspirational pictures and prop ideas for the movie all around your office.
That's right. And one dead clown in the corner that we just breeze past.
So before we get into this movie, which took me 14 years to get made, and having you on it now and shooting it in Vancouver with our great cast, I want to go back to Midland, Texas.
Midland.
Where you grew up. Yeah. Did you always want to be in theater? Did you always know that you wanted to be in entertainment?
Yeah, my earliest memory, I probably was 4 or 5. My dad was an actor in the Midland Community Theater, which still exists, and he was a geologist and a paleontologist for Shell Oil, but loved theater. And my earliest actual memories were being backstage with him, where people were getting in costumes and hair and makeup and doing shows. So I sort of just thought that was normal. I thought that was, but I loved it. And the day we ended up moving from Midland to Houston, I was the lead in Rumpelstiltskin. Still talking about it today. And they waited for the performance to be over with because they didn't want to affect my performance to tell me we were moving to Houston.
Gosh.
But I... that those earliest memories still exist, and that was my beginning love affair with theater and then film and TV.
So why did your dad love theater so much? What was it about it? Did he want to be an actor?
And I think that there was a part of it. I think that there was a part of it that if in another universe, if he could have made a living as an actor and really had given it a thought, I think probably there was a side of him that would have pursued it. But he was University of Wisconsin and met my mom and got his degree in geology. And the first place they would send him, interestingly enough, a lot of oil companies wouldn't hire him because he was Jewish, and Shell was the only one that would hire him. And then they assigned him to Midland, Texas, the sort of Midland, Odessa, Permian Basin, Friday Night Lights. And then he found that theater that was there, and that became for him sort of show after show after show, a great way for him to, I think, explore that side of his life.
Do you remember the first play you saw, the first show there when you were a kid?
I think it would have been.
Or do you remember at least the one that inspired you the most?
1776 definitely inspired me the most. And then Fiddler on the Roof. My mom was working in the tech booth, and she had the distinction. My mom's not a techie, and she blacked out the entire theater, pulled the wrong switch.
Right.
And but those plays and a Neil Simon play, Plaza Suite,
mm-hmm.
And Don't Drink the Water. Those four really were the four significant ones that popped for me as being my dad was funny, and my dad got laughs. And I would sit in the wings and look at the audience laughing at my dad. And there was something really great about that, mm-hmm. that I just thought that's how you do it. And from that point on.
Well, you're very funny, and you always do get laughs on the set. So did you want to be an actor first? Is that what you thought you were going to start
I think
doing?
All I thought I was going to do was be an actor. Oh, so by the time I got to Houston, I was doing anything I could in our school plays, every production. And ended up the Texas Renaissance Festival. I was the court jester there for several years. I did local commercials. And in high school, we had a really famous program from around the country called Razzmatazz, which was sort of high school Saturday Night Live. And I got in my sophomore year, which was a big deal. And you got to perform these pretty racy, in retrospect, pretty racy skits and stuff. Your senior year, they had a thing called student director, where you also got to direct. And so I was getting a taste of that. I got a theater scholarship as an actor to University of Houston, which was where Dennis Quaid had been and Patrick Swayze. And the amazing Cecil Pickett was there, and Sidney Berger. And I was there as an actor. And I had my first year, we were doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and I was part of the kind of player troupe that was really funny. And I had an out-of-body experience. I was up on a riser watching the director direct. And while he was doing it, I was like, it'd be better if that guy went over there. And I think that would be funnier. And that was it. I knew I didn't want to act anymore. I knew I wanted to direct.
Well, wait, we have to go back for one thing, because I got to talk to you about the Renaissance Festival. You were the court jester. Now,
technically, Todd, I was the royal court jester.
The royal court jester.
Here's how.
So did you actually camp out with these people? And
Todd,
okay,
there is nothing more exciting. let me just take
because I've been.
let me just.
I've been to them before, and I've seen them and eaten the turkey.
This is what I want you to do. Why I tell this story. I want you to imagine me in tights, different than the one I'm currently wearing. I want you to imagine me in a homemade tunic.
Well, that's all homemade.
All homemade.
You got to.
And so,
and did you authentic? Was it like authentic?
It was
leather.
Oh,
you didn't
it was
even use
so,
real thread.
Oh no, mine was so authentic. But I was with a group. It was I was a junior in high school. I loved the Renaissance Festival. Again, my dad took us from the minute we got there, and it's one of the best in the country, truly. And I just went, and I wanted ye olde times. And I was obsessed with Monty Python, all of that. And I got in a troupe that was doing a performance of Everyman, one of the original oldest plays. And I was playing one of the characters in it, and we did like seven performances a day. And the troupe was all older, and they hated, like, when they were done performing, they wanted to go back to the tent and, you know, smoke weed or whatever it was. And I was like, this was my performance. And I just created this character, which I decided my name was I Piss Sweat. And
perfect.
And I was the court jester, and there was a real court jester there who was hired to be the court jester, but somehow I felt his performance was
lacking.
Was flat. I didn't like it. Was wrong.
Did he give you side eye when you showed up? Like, whoa.
And the rules were you had to engage with the royal family. Like, if the king walked by, you had to bow. Sure. I was determined to get in on this. And even though I was not paid to do any of it, I created my own sub-character. And one of the rat catchers had dropped a pelt off of his costume, and it got stuck in the mud, and it looked horrible, like a dead animal. I tied a long rope around it, and I named it Fop. And I would get behind large groups of people, and I would go, "Make way for the king's dead cat! Make way for the king's dead cat!" And people would laugh, and they'd open it up, and I would walk through, and then, you know, 30 feet behind me, I'm dragging this dead cat.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Did it the entire season, thinking, like, this is awesome. Like, I hated, the one thing I hated was doing this stupid play.
Right.
Like, I hated the people I was with. I hated everything, but I loved this. Like, nobody was stopping me. The last weekend, the king and the royal court came by and stopped, and it was like deer in headlight. Like, I'm scrunching up my tights. I'm like, I think this is where I get fired. I've broken all rules of protocol for the Renaissance. And the king stops and says, could not have seen this coming a million years. And there's a crowd. Anytime the king or anybody would stop, you know, something's going to go down.
Right.
And the king went, "How is my cat today?"
Oh, that's hilarious.
And I went, "Very much alive? Very good. Very good." And at the end of that weekend, when they would start talking to you about the next year, because it's six weekends in the fall. And they would start talking about next year, and they came and they said, the owners said, "So we want to talk to you about next year." And I was like, I don't really run that company. I'm the wrong person to. And again, I apologize for the creation. And they were like, "No, we want you to come back as the court jester with your cat. We're going to build you a costume." It was the rock star of Renfair. I was transformed. They have a costume designer doing fittings. They do these big parades.
Meanwhile, the real court jester, the guy before, he's just out somewhere.
Angrily
still
smoking. Damn that kid. And I came back. And for years, that was my bit. And then the final year, and I was going to stay. Had I
was
not
there ever, it. Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. Was there ever a younger court jester that tried to make a move on you that you had to slap down?
Oh, no. By this point, not only that, but I was ruling the kingdom because we had just started the King's Feast and I was the host of that. I was Mr. Personality. And you have to assume,
as opposed to how you are now.
Yeah, as opposed to now. Right. But, like, not everybody in the Renaissance ye olde England was Mr. Personality. They were like, "I am a craftsman who makes chainmail. Will you buy it?" I'm, like, in charge of everything. And my favorite thing was, I just got drunk. Like, every day, the funny was me grabbing your beer and drinking it and kissing your wench and, like, making a deal, like, grabbing turkey. Like, every weekend was insanity.
So then what do you do there? Do you stay there? Like,
you
an RV? Or?
Oh, you camp Friday night and Saturday night.
But do you camp, like, legit? Is it, or you get to, like, actually
imagine
be in a
this. And by the way, I love all Renfairs. I truly love my people. The gate would close.
And Renfair, by the way, is just short for Renaissance Fair. Like, you're so in the know, you've shortened.
Guys, you know, if you're talking the RF, you're talking the RF. And it's a breezy Sunday talking the RF. That's going to be my new podcast, Talking Renaissance. Got a white witch here today, and somebody selling crystals. And so the gate would close, and my job was to make sure we got everyone out. But you want people to, A, everyone's drunk by that time, every patron.
Right.
And so you're trying to make sure that they're getting out. The police are there. And you're also, final people are wanting to sell as much stuff as they can. The gate would close. Fires lit, and all the people who work there are just up all night, and they're eating food. People are partying way too hard. But imagine this, 16 years old, my first time to camp there, and I brought my little camp, and I'm setting up my little tent, and my socks are lying out. Like, I walk in, and what I don't realize is the showers are co-ed. And so at 16 years old, I walk in and I'm like, oh, hello, sir. Oh, well, hello there, sir. I'm in an awkward shower. And then I turn and I'm like, oh, and hello there, ma'am. And hello. I'm a 16-year-old kid surrounded by, like, nudity on all sides. And I'm like, I'm the court jester. But it was a lifestyle. And to this day, I mean, they're so well organized and they're so much fun. But I love going every year. We go back to the one in Texas, and I still have friends working there. Wow. And running the place. But there was a brief period where I thought that was what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Wow.
I was going to be like, I'll live like Monty Python. And there was a girl who I ended up
Was the shower the final kicker for you? Were you?
No. At that point, I was like, this is how you do it. This is life. I'm going to. And there were. But the crazy thing was, there was a girl that I'm still close with who became a girlfriend at the time. And she was one of the local wenches. And that is what they're called. I'm not being rude when I call it. They're literally called wenches. And there was a guy who liked her who was one of the musketeers, and he was really fancy and his costume was fancy, and he would constantly come around and find me like he was truly wanting to challenge me to some Hamilton duel. And he would be like, court jester. And I'd be like, yes. And he was a big guy, and he's like, I see you are with my lady. And I'm like, well, I was with your lady in the tent a minute ago, so I'm not sure what she has told you, Your Highness. And then he would go into all of these things. And then when people went around, I would try to talk to him like, hey, that was a cool bit. And he would just really darkly be like, not a bit.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to kill you. And I would watch him, and then I'd like, and remember, we are giving these people weapons. Like, that's the whole thing is, well, you look safe. We're going to give you a sharp sword. Here's 24 beers. And the louder you get, just chase people around with your sword. That was the guy I was with. I don't know whatever happened to him, but I imagine it didn't end well.
Okay. So you come out of jumping to college.
Yeah.
You're going to college in Houston.
In Texas Tech. Well, Texas Tech. University of Houston. And then when I decided I wanted to be a director and I didn't want to act anymore, I was off my scholarship. So I transferred to Texas Tech in Lubbock, which is back in West Texas by Midland. And they didn't have, I mean, they had a theater program, but they didn't have film or television. So I was really getting sort of focusing on history and mass communications. And then still not knowing how to do it. But when I graduated, I came straight from Lubbock to LA. 5 bags, put everything in storage. My uncle lived in Long Beach, and it was a wing and a prayer of like, okay. Wow. And I did kept thinking, worst comes to worst. I graduated in May, and the next Renaissance Festival would be October. And my timeline.
Is this always your fallback, by the way? Now, if you don't get a movie,
was the Renaissance Festival. Like, other people were like, well, I've got my degree and I'll probably start marketing for Procter & Gamble.
Right.
I'm like, really? Because I have not hung up that court jester costume. And you couple of washes, you get, you know, the sweats are fine. And I took my court jester costume with me, and that was my timeline. If I did not get work between May and September, then I would come back to Texas.
Amazing.
And rejoin my family in the Renaissance Festival. I think they actually even offered me like more money. And anyone I talked to obviously have the thing of like, but dude, you went to college. I was like, yeah, the college of the Texas Renaissance Festival. And I'll be happy there for life. Yeah. And I truly believe I probably would be there now doing it.
So what is the first theater production that you directed?
Well, the first real theater production I did in Lubbock, Texas, called Same Time Next Year, which was at a community theater, and it was with real adult actors, and I was in college, and that was the one that was probably the most legit, like, all right, now I'm doing it. Then while I was there, I would direct anything. So I was directing Chamber of Commerce shows. I was directing, we wrote a Wizard of Oz, come to Lubbock, Texas. It's just follow the yellow brick road to Lubbock. I was directing Christmas carols, you name it. I would do it because I just wanted the opportunity. So when I got to LA, I had all of that under my belt, but nothing that was, here's my resume. And the most legit thing on there was the Renaissance Festival.
Wow. And you are a huge movie file. I mean, you love movies. You have a big one of the biggest collections of DVDs I've ever seen. Do you remember movies growing up affecting you the same way theater did?
So much. I remember the first movie. There was a drive-in theater, Big Chief Drive-In, between Midland and Odessa, 16 miles to get there.
It's called Big Chief Drive-In.
And what was great was it was so flat, you could see about 10 minutes going one way and 10 minutes going the other way. And they also played like the R-rated movies. So we'd be going like from one town to the other, like 16 miles down like Andrews Highway or whatever. And you'd be looking, I'd be like, oh my. But the first movie I remember going to at the drive-in, my mom and dad, my dad loved movies too, but I saw the perfect movie to bring a child to. They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Oh, wow.
A Depression era drama that made no, like, I was crying, like, but are they going to shoot the horses? I don't want them to shoot the horses. I'm watching over the corner. I remember that very distinctly. I remember Patton in the movie theater and the audience, the first in Midland, the American flag comes up and you're watching that. And then Midland's very patriotic. And Mr. Hodge, who owned Hodge Theater, and all of a sudden people are standing up in the theater. And then you hear George C. Scott, like people are like thinking it's flag, I'm going to pledge allegiance. And you hear George C. Scott with all of his like, I'm going to murder me, the nana man. And people are just like, oh no, that was inspirational. And then like weeks later, I think I saw like Jonathan Livingston Seagull, so all of those movies really inspired me. But I'd say the ones that, because I could watch everything. They did a million-dollar movie at 3 o'clock every afternoon on TV, and I would watch, because I had three older brothers, and my dad was a movie buff. Any movie that was on, like Captain Blood or the Marx Brothers, my dad always wanted me to watch. And my dad really encouraged me with, he loved British comedy, and so I got to watch Monty Python early. But in the theaters, you know, the classics, Jaws forever changed everything for me.
Oh, me
seeing
too.
It was
me
like,
too. That was the one.
I was like, that everything about it, I still watch it.
It's a pretty big constant here. People that I talked to that got into the movie business, that they watched a movie that was totally inappropriate for their age. And it just f***ed them.
Scared.
And they couldn't get over it. And they went, holy shit, well, if I can make somebody feel like I'm feeling right now, that's what I want to do with my life.
That for me was Jaws.
Yeah, me too.
So much so that everybody at our company at Oops Donuts, we were at Martha's Vineyard and we watched Jaws on Martha's Vineyard just because you had to. Raiders of the Lost Ark, my mom dropped me off for the first showing at the local AMC theater.
Raiders of the Lost Ark for me more than Star Wars.
Yeah, Raiders, I'm going to say the same thing. Yeah. Because Raiders, I went to the first showing. She was going to pick me up. I went to the payphone. I was like, Mom, I have to stay. I watched Raiders maybe six times in a row that day.
Wow.
She picked me up at like 9 o'clock. And because it was every time he pulled out the pistol and shot the guy.
Yeah.
I was like, my mind was blown. Star Wars, Animal House probably had the most effect on my comedy because everything about Animal House to me was perfection. Yep. And I remember National Lampoon put out a book, kind of an illustrated graphic novel of Animal House that had photos, sort of photo funnies. I remember buying at 7-Eleven and sitting in the back of the car as my mom was driving. I'm just reading it. And I'm like, this is amazing. Those movies
changed.
Yeah.
For me, yeah. I mean, for me, for my comedy, the things that I remember the most were Caddyshack, Stripes, Arthur, for sure, Animal House. You know, those movies are just so
profoundly affected me. And by the way, those ones that you
just named,
say, like, I would come out of Arthur and I would quote endlessly. I would do Caddyshack. I would do, you know, Stripes. I would do, like it was a lot of the Bill Murray.
Yeah,
and
me too.
I think truly, because 1974, if you think about the kind of birth of Saturday Night Live and the sort of launch of Belushi and Aykroyd and eventually Murray and Chevy, that world, Gilda, that world was really inspiring for me comedically. And then because my dad was a massive Gene Wilder fan, all the like Young Frankenstein producers, Blazing Saddles. So when eventually I got to work for Gene, a lot of my comedy had been inspired by watching him over the years. So I feel like for so many like you, so many people who I know who, because you have a genuine love for comedy and you also, Todd's, for those of you who don't know, Todd's not just an attractive man with what I'm assuming is fake hair and a Kenny Rogers beard. And just Google right now, Kenny Rogers roasters. and then go, that's Todd eating chicken.
Thank you, Andy, for doing that. That's going to be really fun for people to do.
You know comedy, but you also love movies. So you're one of the few people I know in town that any time we can bring up a movie, you not only know it, you know the reference, you know the line. You've really dug in. And I think for so many of us in the business, we're here because we were fans of movies. We're fans of television, fans of theater. So we're getting to play in the playground that somebody else played in before us. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to give back to people, is you want the next generation to have the same experience we had.
And also, I think probably because that's when VHS really started, that you could watch those movies over and over. I watched Stripes and Caddyshack and Arthur 100 times easily.
You had to, because I didn't know Belushi said zit, right, because the laugh was so crushing in the theater, and I'd seen it maybe 3 times. Everyone laughed so hard, I couldn't figure out. I thought that's what he was saying. Wasn't until I got the VHS, and I'd like slow.
Yeah.
And then I would make my dubs. I would go buy it like Walmart or caught, like I'd get like 10 of the blank VHS tapes, and I'd take two VCRs. Now I believe it's called pirating. But back then it was just a young man in a court jester's outfit exploring modern technology as best he could. And I would take every movie and then I would dub it so I'd have it forever. Yeah. And so all I wound up with was like 400 with like the lines going across. And I was like, but still the greatest movie ever.
So what your first thing that you actually directed that was probably, you know, using the term loosely here, professional, was Reefer Madness, right?
Thing, right before I had a chance to do an indie film that was truly my learning curve, and that was Who's Your Daddy? Mm-hmm. And that was Verna Hara, who...
That was 2005,
who,
right?
Yeah, Verna Hara, who we had done Anaconda with, and she was so wonderful for us. She was, she helped, you know, put that together. And that was actually 2001 when we first did it. And there was a whole financing issue. There was all kinds of weird things involved with some of the other producers. But I learned everything on that movie. And that movie prepared me. While I had been a producer on Anaconda, you know, sometimes the difference between just being in the producer chair and jumping to the director mm-hmm. chair, pretty significant. And as much as I had been directing a lot of theater, putting all that for film was tricky. And he knows I call him my godfather all the time, but Bob Greenblatt, who has been on your show and is amazing. Bob had seen Reefer Madness, which I directed at our theater in Los Angeles at the Hudson Theater.
Okay, so hold on. So pause 1 second, because we've also jumped over a huge chunk of your life, which is really interesting.
No, we talked about the Renaissance Festival. Oh, you're talking about my executive
Yes.
Years.
And so that's when you and I actually met.
That's
when I was at Disney and you were working for Bette Midler's company.
That's right.
Was that your first job as a development person?
No, so the quick of it was as soon as I landed here, what kept me from going back to being a court jester was I got a job as a tour guide at Universal Studios.
Oh, right.
Loved it. Probably would have kept doing that too. And then everybody in college was like calling and graduating. They're all like becoming lawyers and doctors. And they're like, now what do you do? And I was like, currently doing PR for Universal Studios. And I'm like, that's amazing. We want to come out and visit you. I'm like, nope. No. And then in the background, you'd hear like tram for Andy Fickman. Andy Fickman, you have a tram waiting for you. And they're like, what is that? And I'm like, no, it's my good friend Tram. I gotta go. My buddy Tram's waiting for me. And so I did that. And then I wound up in the mail room of Triad, which eventually merged with William Morris, which then became part of All Endeavor. But so I went in the mail room at Triad and learned so much in the mail room. And then I really learned I didn't want to be an agent. And I was in the program. And the agent I was working for was the first comedy packaging agent at Triad. And he and I, we went and had lunch with Gene Wilder's producing partner named Susan Ruskin and her head of development, Fonda Snyder. And at lunch, they were talking about one of our great clients, Mike Binder's amazingly talented. And at the end of it, I don't know why, but I said to Fonda as we were all walking back, I was like, hey, if you ever hear of a development job, I'd love an opportunity. Didn't know anything. Weeks later, she calls me and says, I'm leaving to go to Disney to help run Martin Short's production company. Susan Ruskin, who you had, she really liked you. Do you want to come in and interview? And are you kidding me to go work for Susan and Gene Wilder? And I raced over there, you know, sort of told them I knew how to do development. And they were like asking all, so you read Publishers Weekly? And I'm like, do I read it? By the way, I read it weekly when it's published. And they're like, Kirkus Reviews? I'm like, I think I know Bill Kirkus and his review. And I didn't know track. They're like, are you on a tracking board? Yeah, of course. I get the job.
We should probably say the Publishers Weekly is actually a weekly publication where they actually show, they talk about all the books that are being published that week, all the new books. They have a little blurb
on
them. And
same as Kirkus Reviews.
Kirkus Reviews is the same thing. And a tracking board is when a bunch of young executives get together and they track material and they, you know, they do it over email and they say, hey, this script is coming out here. This script's coming from WME. These are the people that are attached. And, you know, you've tried to get into that group so you when your boss says, hey, what specs are going out, you can say, all of these specs are going out.
And it was, and there was a system to it. I just didn't know anything. By the way, had someone just said what you said to me, I would have learned so much
more.
There
you go. And there was no internet. Jobs now can say
like,
that.
There's no internet then, and nobody's. I was like, so I got the job, and I remember so excited. And then it dawned on me I didn't know what I was supposed to do. And Fonda, who is still so important to me in my life now, Fonda, I would call her every day at Martin Short's company. I was like, what do I want? And she's like, do this, do that. And that really grew Susan Ruskin, who's still very much in my life, and Gene were amazing because they let me have my theater company. And Gene was also a writer director. My first pitch ever was to Gene. And at the very end, he so polite. It was like a 5-hour pitch where he was like a homeless man. Like, right. It was the mini series of pitches where every minute on screen was 5 minutes of a pitch. And I had a 120-minute movie. And I remember at the end, just so quiet. And just Gene looked at me and went, that was horrible, but good for you that you tried it. He and Susan would support my directing and give me ideas. Right. And so I worked for the company was called Pall Mall Productions. I do remember at the moment I got out and everybody was like, you got out of the training program. I'm like, I'm the one. And weeks later, a friend of mine who was also a trainee, he called. He goes, I also got a director of a CE job. I was like, really? Where? And he got a job working for Michelle Pfeiffer. And I was like, what? That was wait, hold on.
I didn't realize that was a possibility.
I didn't know. Yeah, I love Jean very much, but she's there right now, Michelle Pfeiffer. Please let me interview.
Oh. So where was Jean in his career at that time?
Gilda had just passed.
Okay, so what was he looking to do? What was he looking for?
We had a deal at TriStar, and he was still very much, you know, he was in mourning over the loss of Gilda, but had a lot of stuff in development and wasn't wanting not to work, just needed to find the right thing. And it was a unique time period because there was definitely a sadness pervasive throughout the office.
Right.
But we worked on a couple of movies that got made, and it was a opportunity to work with Richard Pryor on one of his last films. But I learned so much. And then Gene, I think, knew he just was ready to sort of move back east. It was all not the way it had been. Mm-hmm. And Bette Midler was looking for somebody. And I knew somebody who got me an opportunity to go there. And she was a massive fan of Gene's. And I went over, and all I kept thinking was, if nothing happens, I'm going to meet Bette Midler, who also had a profound impact on me as a viewer, all of the movies that she had done. And I got hired to work. I was the all-boy at All Girl.
Yeah, their company was called All Girl.
All-girl
and they had
production.
A deal with Touchstone Pictures because she had made Ruthless People there and Beaches there. And she was partnered with Bonnie Bruckheimer, who is the ex-wife of Jerry, if anybody's wondering why. Her name is Bruckheimer also. And so you were there as in development when I was there.
Yeah,
as
I
was a director of development as well. And
that's when I met
together.
You mm-hmm. because we were we did Hocus Pocus.
Yeah.
We were working on Chevy Chase and Man in the House. Mm-hmm. But it was this going from Gene to Bette, it was having that opportunity to work with working with two of the greats. And by then I'd really started to learn development and loved it. But I was also spending as much time writing and directing on the side, especially theater.
Because you had done Reefer Madness by this point.
Reefer Madness I had not done yet. Reefer Madness would happen. After that is when I, Susan Ruskin, Gene's old partner, Susan ended up partnering with Verna Hara at what became Middle Fork Productions. And they brought me over and I went there. And that was all kind of in process with Reefer Madness started becoming a big hit while I was there. We did Anaconda. And so I had gone, and I was at this moment where Verna looked at me, and it was probably the scariest and greatest moment. She said, you have to make a choice now. Are you going to be a director and a writer? Are you going to do it? Or are you going to be a development exec?
Right.
And with the success of Reefer, I just felt like, okay, I'm going to try to be a director. And I rented my office from her. I rented and kept my assistant, Lori, who was amazing and with me forever. And Betsy Sullinger, who you know well. Betsy's my producing partner now at Oops Donuts. Betsy was another executive there. And Betsy and I started talking from that moment, like, what would we do if we had our own opportunity? And then Reefer Madness...
How did you get the money for Reefer Madness to put that play up?
So we did it. It was a big hit in Los Angeles, broke every record, one of the longest running comedies in LA, one of the musicals, and won every award. And then we moved to New York, and we were very excited. And we opened literally, we were there in rehearsals when 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And Kristen Bell joined us there and was playing the lead, and a wonderful cast, a lot of our LA people. But we were in New York during 9/11,
wow.
And we had to open the show weeks after 9/11. Like, it was it was everything about the experience of 9/11 from that morning when I was on my way to rehearsal, where I was living on 88th and 3rd. Like, everything about it is still forged in my head. But at the end of that, the show opening closed. Nobody was going to theater. Anthrax, the day our opening night was the day we declared war. There was a tank in front of our theater. It was bad. We all thought Dan Studney and Kevin Murphy, my writers and I, we just thought it was over.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with the idea of doing a stage reading in L.A. at the Cornette Theater to see if anyone was interested in a feature version of it. And Bob Greenblatt, who, when he was with David John Alari, two of the all-time greats, had seen Who's Your Daddy, that movie that I made that eventually came out, but at the time was still mired in all difficulties. They saw it as a one-time-only screening at the WGA, and they were very supportive of me. And Bob, it was maybe his second or third day at Showtime, Bob called. Didn't know really, I don't think he knew anyone at Showtime. He goes, hey, what if we make Reefer Madness my first project or one of my first projects, and jumped. And from that moment, Bob was instrumental in Showtime making it happen. And we were in production not too long later. And then we premiered at Sundance Film Festival. That's when I was getting new agents. Everything, Reefer Madness really launched. You know, became Emmy Award winning. We won Deauville Film Festival, the premier audience prize, and two prestigious High Times Stony Awards. But
yeah,
everything,
two-time Stony Award.
Two
winner.
Times, that's right. But everything about Reefer really changed for me, because then I think it just put me on the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, it was official. Now I'm going to be directing.
Can't keep up with all the latest scandals?
It's a bullshit question.
Then it's time to check out Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One.
I was going to unleash a torrent on anybody who was violating attorney-client privilege. I was pissed.
Join world-renowned criminal defense lawyer Mark Garagos as he reviews the latest in our nation's most high-profile legal cases with podcast king Adam Carolla.
Well, then we're circling back to MJ.
Okay.
Because I'm not done with that.
Download new episodes of Reasonable Doubt every Saturday on Podcast One.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is the Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
So walk me through after doing an R-rated, you know, stoner comedy, when do you make the pivot into more of the family space? And then walk me through kind of like what those first experiences were like.
The pivot was almost right away. When I first went to all my interviews where people were looking, different agencies, they all were, because of Reefer Madness, I think they saw me as very much a, I was going to do indie, cool, like that was it. And I love that. I'm a kid from Texas. Like, Smokey and the Bandit 2 was a big night for me at the theater. Irwin Allen, Disaster Man. So I wanted to do mall movies. Mm-hmm. And the first round of scripts I was reading after Reefer, all of them were very, you know, cocaine fiends or, right. you know, heroin honeys right. or any, you just needed a drug's name, you know, meth mamas. And I'm like, am I that guy? And, like, you know, meanwhile, I'm just like doing a lot of meth and cocaine. And like, I think I'm that guy. And I, the police asked me to stop. And I'm all right. And then I read the script for She's the Man. And I had done 12th Night directorially. Like, I knew the play well. I loved what She's the Man was going to be. And nobody, like, I just remember calling my agents, and they're like, really? Well, you just done Reefer Madness, Sundance, High Times Magazine. You do you want to pivot to what seems to be a teen girl movie? And I'm like, oh, yes. And I went in, and the only thing was, the only thing people could see was Reefer Madness. So everybody that was looking at me for the job, like, I was up against people who had legit movies that correlated with She's the Man. And then you look at Reefer Madness, you're like, that is a hard
right.
that is a hard turn. But Lauren Shuler Donner and Jack Leslie championed me and got over to DreamWorks, and Mark Hames really, and Gene Allgood at the time, really championed me, and Adam Goodman, we sort of dove in, and that was the first movie right after Reefer for me. And it And then that led to, I came out of that, and while I was in post on She's the Man, that led to The Game Plan at Disney, and it got further and further away. So people would be like, you've never done anything edgy, and I was right. like, go yeah. back to the beginning of my career.
That's always the way.
But it was, I think it was just movies that I wanted to go see. Right. My son at the time, Austin, I wanted movies he could enjoy, and I still felt like I was doing the types of movies that I would want to go see as an audience member.
Well, it's a good segue to why we're here in Vancouver making this movie called Playing with Fire with John Cena and John Leguizamo and Keegan-Michael Key and Judy Greer and Dennis Haybert and Brianna Hildebrand. And it's a throwback. I mean, when you and I were doing it, it's funny, when Paramount was having their green light meeting, you know, they used all pretty much every comp that either you or I or both of us had worked on. And it is a throwback. It is sort of that, you know, Daddy Daycare, 3 Men and a Baby, Game Plan, movie where you have, you know, a bunch of adult men that should be able to handle anything are being undone by kids. And this is a movie that I had when I left Revolution. It was the first movie that I developed because I thought, oh, this will be the easiest thing to get made because these movies always do well. And then at that moment, those movies no longer became sexy. And in a weird way, they seeded these live action movies to animation. So you look at yeah. Despicable Me, look at Incredibles, even Up, you know, these movies are all basically the Game Plan and Parental Guidance and Daddy Daycare. And so it took 14 years for me to get this movie made now with Nickelodeon and Paramount and Brian Robbins. When I first went over there to start talking about moving my deal there, you know, he had produced Radio for me, and Wick Godfrey, who is the president of production there, had produced Daddy Daycare for me. So they got it right away. Like, why don't we make these kind of movies anymore? And so what is it about, like, this movie and comedies, the family comedies in general, that really do you think, first of all, why do you think they're so maligned? And second of all, what's like the best part of making these movies for you?
I think the malign part comes from any time you do four quadrant, sort of 8 to 80, there's a sense that you're kind of going across the board with a smorgasbord of comedy, mm-hmm. smorgasbord of heart. So that, you know, how could it possibly be cool and edgy if everybody liked it?
Right.
And I think that's always been for a lot of general audiences where people come out and say, I had a great time. Mm-hmm. And we're not a superhero movie. We're not an edgy R-rated
right.
movie, which I can love like Animal House. But I think that that's been it, is the idea is that if an 8-year-old could laugh at something a 30-year-old could laugh at, how smart is that comedy? And I've always been a believer to this day that comedy is so subjective.
Oh, yeah.
That to review, the thing I hate hearing usually is that's not funny. Because that's not funny implies you somehow know more right. about comedy.
Right.
It should be that's not funny to me. It's not my sense of humor. That I can respect for days. And I think that family entertainment has gone through that. I think that, and there probably is enough things where maybe it tilted more for the 8-year-old than the older audience member. I think that's what sort of excited me about movies like Game Plan or Parental Guidance, and specifically Playing with Fire, was why can't we entertain a family? Why right. can't we entertain? It's hard enough to find something for everybody. Why not? And if you can get an audience laughing, there's no greater feeling mm-hmm. than watching you being able to take your kids. And when people will tell me, I was so hard to find something to take the family to. We had a show on Disney Channel, Liv and Maddie, for many years. And we loved hearing from adults who said, my kid loves your show. I love your show. That was part of our, that was a big drive for me. And Playing with Fire felt like it was a throwback to that world, but also felt, and we see it every day on the set with this cast, mm-hmm. like I don't need a kid to go see this movie.
Right.
I would enjoy this movie.
And if you are trying to make movies for, you know, 8 to 80, as we say, you do, and even the animated movies do, there is an expectation there's going to be physical humor, right? Because the kids have to be able to grasp it, and there has to be humor for the adults as well. But obviously, you're constrained by your rating. And when you look at movies like the Pixar movies and the great animated movies, I mean, those movies cost $100+ million. They generally have gone through rewrites and rewrites, and it's almost like a play where yeah. you can send it, kind of feel what's working. You know, generally these movies are not the most expensive movies. You have one shot at it. You know, you're really cast dependent. We were incredibly lucky that John Cena wanted to do this because he's the perfect fit for it. And so, yeah, I have the same experience. It's hard because I love, and the thing that gets me going the most is definitely not the reviews, because I've had really well reviewed movies that have not made any money, and I've had obviously huge successes that didn't get any good ratings. I mean, any good critiques. And so it's a fascinating thing to me. And I've also had movies that I thought were better than the Rotten Tomato score, and I've had movies that I thought were worse than the Rotten Tomato score, quite frankly. And again, it really is about the subjective, this subjectivity of somebody's, you know, sense of humor. And, you know, having made Tag, which is very R-rated, and now making this movie that's PG, I love the most the previews. I mean, it's really the thing that gets me going the most is watching a real audience of 450, 500 people watch your movie. And that's why you say, like, oh, it's really not funny, because I've seen, you know, a couple thousand people watch this movie and laugh, you know, hysterically.
Comedy doesn't lie. The
right.
best thing about comedy,
that's why it's so hard, too.
It's so hard because it's just, if you try it and 1,000 people don't laugh, you don't get to run out and be like, come on, you're all stupid.
Right.
Did you not see how he fell?
Right.
If they laugh, that was you did it. You did exactly what you set out to do. And I think sometimes when people are reviewing, critically sort of trying to look at a comedy like this or physical comedy, it's a little bit like you have the knives out before it even starts.
Oh, yeah.
Because the idea is, look, if Buster Keaton fell down right now, that's just a Pratt, that's a physical comedy gag. How many people in real life do you know fall down like that? And you're like, that's not real life. I'm entertaining you. And if I can entertain you, and like you said at that preview, man, that first laugh when it's where you want it to be,
mm-hmm.
that's great. I had a crazy experience in France during the Deauville Film Festival, because with Reefer Madness, we were there, and I knew at that point every place there was a laugh. And I knew where the first one was to the last one. And they bring you up and they're doing the intro, and they have I don't speak French. It was not part of what I learned as a court jester. It was the Renaissance of Texas, not obviously the Renaissance of French. And so they're interviewing me, and I had done so many intros where I knew how to warm the audience up with my pot humor. But here, I'm saying something, and she's translating it. And then, like, 2 minutes later, they laugh. Problem is, I don't know what part they're laughing at, so I can't build off of it.
Right.
So now I'm just like, I don't know. Literally, it's just punchlines. Like, right. Brenda Vaccaro. I don't know what even that means.
Right.
And so then they start the movie, and I'm there. And they have it, DeVille. They have this weird thing where the director sits under a light, like the audience can see, which is worse. I'm wearing a suit. I am Albert Brooks in broadcast news. My suit is Aquaman within about 3 minutes. Drenched. Not a single laugh. So now it's getting worse. To where now I hate, like, I just want to, I'm like, who directed this piece of crap? Not me. And now they come over and the publicist is like, in the middle of the movie, they want to bring you out to put you on French television live right now. They take me outside. I'm truly just wet. I'm on some panel show, and they're all trying to dab me dry, and they're looking at me like the fat American is grown. He's like a sponge. And then they put, and the first questions they're asking me are about, do I know the difference between French comedy and American comedy? Well, what I've just learned moments ago is that the French are not particularly funny at laughing at my humor. And I'm sitting there, but they have to translate. I'm still trying to be light. This panel was like, not one of them had ever been funny. It was a horrible experience. The publicist then, as soon as that's done, the movie's letting out. And he leans over and he goes, there's another week of the festival. He goes, you might not have to stay for the full week. I was like, what? What? Like, what do you mean? Like, do they hate it? No, it's just we booked flights and let's get you a towel and just take you straight to the airport. And I walk past all these people and the people are looking at me truly like it was just insanity. Like, I look like a fish and they're all like, what's wrong with him?
Mm-hmm.
I go back to the hotel room. I'm changing. I'm all depressed. And everybody in America is like, do they love us in France? And I'm like, well, I'm going to bring baguettes for everyone. The French, yay. Almost out the door, a publicist runs back. No, let's stay. They might like you. I'm like, well, they didn't like me. We ended up winning.
Oh, wow.
And what later in an interview where I was so confused, I'm like, I made a comedy and what I normally was expecting was laughter. And what I got was sweat and pain.
Right.
And they said, oh, we were reading the subtitles. And so by reading it, you just don't have time to.
No.
It's going so fast.
Oh, wow.
And it was a massive lesson to me.
Yeah.
To realize that comedy overseas was going to play different. But that the physical comedy, you could laugh immediately. Didn't need, but verbal comedy, maybe that's not a reference over there.
Right.
So everything to me about comedy being so subjective, it'd be like somebody, it's like the worst thing when you've got somebody looking at you show them something, and then just nothing comes out, and then they're like, it's hysterical.
Right.
You're like,
yeah.
Is something inside of you that is laughing so
right,
hard?
Right.
I think when family entertainment happens, I just think it's probably people sometimes are like, oh, I don't know if I want to watch this. But when they go in groups and have that sort of fun, there's nothing like it.
Nothing. And the thing is, it's so interesting because if you go to Disneyland by yourself.
Okay. That was three times. Okay. And to be clear.
I don't mean by yourself.
I thought I would meet friends. I was on an app that was like, find a friend at Disneyland.
If you go to Disneyland as an adult.
Correct.
You have a different experience than if you go to Disneyland with your kids.
And
watching your kids experience Disneyland for the first time and the wonder and the magic of it and seeing, you know, if you're walking with your adult friends and you're like, oh, cool, let's go check out the new Star Wars thing or let's ride Indiana Jones. Oh, here comes Mickey. But when you're there with kids and they see Mickey and the magic of that, that's the thing I think the critics miss the most because, look, you know, Pixar movies are spectacular. And I think what Illumination is doing is spectacular. And that is the gold standard. And again, if you know something's not working, they can rewrite it. Pixar movies are famous for it's not working, throw it out, start over. We can't do that. We're going off of, is this going to be funny? is this going to be funny to kids? Is it going to be funny to adults? And we're out here. Look, and by the way, you and I are in the thick of it right now. We're in March and it's snowing in Vancouver. And people keep saying, it never snows in Vancouver. Well, apparently it does because it is snowing. And, you know.
And awkwardly, Todd and I only brought Speedos.
Yes, it's
and
really
we're
weird.
Just showing up every day told, on set with a Speedo.
I was told there was going to be
some. I was told this would be very warm. The Speedo feels awkward.
Not to make excuses for it, but we're in the thick of it. And you're doing, you know, we're doing our best to make it as funny and humanly possible, and casting has a big part of that, obviously. But it's a different experience when you're a critic watching a movie to be critical of it, so of a comedy, and not. And I've even had my movies, some of them, especially when I was at Disney. I mean, like, yeah, there was a bunch of people and fam. They seemed to like it, laugh it. But this is the low hanging fruit piece of shit comedy. I mean, all granted that, you know, the people in the audience were laughing their asses off, but, you know, as a critical piece of art, this sucks ass, you know? So it's like, you're going, wow, that you're totally missing the point. You're going to Disneyland by yourself. Like, fine, I agree. Disneyland's amazing and at one level it works, but that's the thing that I love the most is taking my kids to Disneyland, because I'm not just basing Disneyland just on my lined experience. I'm looking at my kids going, and to this day, I have an 18-year-old son, still loves it. And you go all the
every
time.
Every year, yeah, you Austin go and I go to Disney World for 2 weeks.
And I think that's why you and I love this so much. I love doing that. I love making movies and seeing kids laugh and enjoy it. And I still have kids. My daughter went to a sleepover the other night, and I thought they were pranking me. And my daughter calls me and goes, Daddy, we watched Mall Cop on our sleepover. And I'm like, yeah, okay, what? And then what happened? And she's like, that's the movie that that my friend can watch with her dad. And they watch it all the time. They love it. Like, that makes me so happy.
But that was, I think I told you when you called me about Mall Cop 2, Mall Cop 1 was one of the great experiences for my son and I. We loved it. It was a dad-son extravaganza, made us laugh. And when you can also find shared laughter with your kids and you realize something that made you laugh is something that makes them laugh, there's a brilliant connection, because that's a bond that you can't break. All of a sudden, it's a unique moment that they are finding something similar to your brain. You're both laughing at the same thing.
Right.
And I love that. And we see it, you know, for our audience, every 2 weeks we show a sizzle reel here of what we previously shot. And you get the cast and crew. And we have all ages, but we have a lot of our little kids, and then we have their doubles. And they're always on the front row. But watching them laugh at stuff that they're not in, but laughing at physical comedy and watching the adults laugh, that's where you take away and be like, all right, this is another day. And you said it, which is the heart of comedy. You only have your gut instinct.
Yeah.
You have dramas. If we do nothing but shoot the words, we're in good shape. If we just, you say those words and I'll push in and I'll do that. And here's a shot of a glass of water and I'll leave that on for, if I did a 5-minute shot of a glass of water in a drama, people would be like, it's the most brilliant, revolutionary, like, not right. Since the French way.
I saw the reflection of my soul.
Did you see my soul? With it? Mm-hmm. If I put that 5-minute glass of water in there, they'd be like, did they run out of shot? Like, what?
Yeah.
I don't understand what was happening with that shot. But that's why I think, and it is hard also with your cast, because you want your cast to have the freedom to be funny. And you and I, and both in our careers, have had tremendous opportunity to work with some of the funniest people around. Mm-hmm. You have to create a base that allows them to feel comfortable because they have to go out knowing they are going to be judged doing something that doesn't fall in the dramatic category. Mm-hmm. And not about awards, but you look at the history of the Academy Awards. You look at the history of comedy and how it's been reflected there, our genre films like horror or sci-fi. And you see that sometimes the critical eye follows one path, and sometimes the audience eye follows a different path. And I am happy to be a part of the audience. When you get that you know, cinema score of what the audience scored you that night, that is a great feeling when they responded the same way.
Right.
And when you hear those previews, that makes you happy. And you also respect them. We've all been in a situation where we've nursed a joke. It didn't work. and you snip it out because the audience was very frank with you.
Yeah. And again, the mall cop movies are so maligned by people, critics mostly. You know, the first one made like 150 something million, 170 million to whatever it was. And the second one made $112 million. Like, these movies are massively successful and make people laugh and do what they're supposed to do. That's the other thing. It's like, if you had a tool, if you have a screwdriver and the screwdriver takes the fucking bolt out,
right. You
go, that's a pretty successful screwdriver. You wouldn't go, yeah, but there's a better screwdriver that has this handle and it's
the
leather.
French screwdriver.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. It's also, I mean, I'm not apologizing for the mall cop movies, but what I'm saying is we set out to make families have a good night out. Be entertained or a good day with their families and not, you know, you don't want to offend anybody. You don't want to have any awkward, weird conversations with your kids coming home. These things are not designed to do that. They're designed to be Disneyland. They're designed
and
to entertain
people. What you just said is that you're also designing it to be that I want the people bringing everyone to this theater to know that we respect what we're asking you to do, which is to sit.
Yeah.
And that we don't want you to be driving home being like, I don't know why he killed the hooker.
Daddy, what's that? Exactly.
What happened to the bicycle? Right. The kid needed to die is what happened. Right. And I think we learned a valuable lesson that when we ask too much at the dinner table, death follows.
Exactly. But that's the other thing. It's like, you know, a horror movie is supposed to scare you, and if it delivers that, then that's quality, that it's done its job. A drama is supposed to make you feel, you know, family entertainment is supposed to pull at your heartstrings and have a lesson and make you laugh. And they're hard, and it's really, really hard. And by the way, you it's a very easy, it's like it's a big bright light to, like, you know, have a guy get kicked in the groin. It's just it's gonna work. And that's the thing that critics hate the most, too, is when you're just, you know, being lazy and you're just going for that joke over and over again.
But what's interesting to me is always that because I find comedy so hard, what you're looking at is the history of comedy, that those who came before us and the Harold Lloyds and the Buster Keatons and the Charlie Chaplins and the
Dudley Moores,
that group understood that the heart of comedy still is the heart of comedy.
Right.
Something befell that individual. Something was the Book of Job. Mm-hmm. You keep raining it down on him, and you laugh. And so where you would want to say the reason why people laugh about that person falling down, big man falls down, gets a laugh, might not be your sense of humor, but for a lot of people, that's the laugh that they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, when you are doing that, you watch your crew too. And like, sometimes we'll see, like, it's a hardened crew. And when they're laughing at stuff, you're feeling pretty good about it. And also the marketplace today, it's a much more sophisticated marketplace because of all the options everyone has to watch things. So I can watch, you know, 10 deadliest snake attacks right before I watch another movie that's supposed to warm my heart.
Right.
And so you have to keep working a little harder to deliver, but the age doesn't change. The 5-year-old is not all of a sudden just acting like a 40-year-old. And so I think that challenge of us saying, come on in, we're going to entertain you. We're going to take away your troubles for a little bit.
Yeah.
That's what we want.
And that's the thing. I think that critics probably think that, you know, either we're stupid, which we're not. We both went to college and we both have degrees and we're not stupid.
Some of us worked at the Renaissance Festival.
True. Or we're lazy. And I'm not. I'm working my ass off on this movie and I'm sitting there every day going, God, is there anything to tweak? Can we make it funnier? Doing our best to deliver on the laughs and deliver on the heart. And that's the thing I think, you know, when you're comparing it to like Get Out, you know, where it's like just all of a sudden Jordan just hits a home run. No, obviously that comes along once in a career. I mean, Jordan's case probably more so. But like those movies are just, it's lightning in a bottle. And so for us who have to make a living doing this, and we have to continually keep making a movie a year, it's hard. And you're again, this one took 14 years to get married. To get married. There you go. Paging Dr. Freud.
just lean made. Back, Todd, and tell me a little bit more.
Be like, we're married, Andy. You're my work husband.
14 years ago, where were you?
So I don't want to gloss over, though, something you said, which was your sizzle reel. So there's something that I would love to just spend a few minutes. And by the way, I got to be respectful of your time because we've got to get back to work. But
Todd, you're my boss. I can technically, as long as you sign my card.
We do have to get back to work.
But I'm really kind of good. And I'd ordered a sandwich and I really don't want to leave until the sandwich gets here.
So I don't want to gloss over this because for young directors, this is something you do, which is so great. And it is ridiculously time consuming, and I am in awe of you for doing it. But what Andy does every night, you do a journal, and you're very funny, and you make it humorous and light, but you kind of tell what happened during the day for all the people that are not on our set, that aren't witnessing this. And then the other thing you do is you cut a sizzle reel every couple weeks, which is just a little fun set to music generally of, you know what we've shot. And then what it does for the studio is it brings them into, it's not just a movie out there that's being filmed. And it's not just this amorphous thing of dailies where you don't know, because everything's being shot out of order. And, you know, some people don't know if there's a master being shot, for example. And so doing those two things for young directors, if they did that, it's just so valuable. What gave you the idea to do those two things specifically?
The first one, in terms of the journal, really stemmed from being an executive initially, because when you're an executive, you spend so much time, 14 years, nursing a project. You are the battlefield. Every writer's list, every director's list, everything, every meeting you had where you talked to the director of development at a studio to pitch that project. Sometimes it was born with your idea. That's on your docket. And what I found that I really hated was that I would be a part of the process, nursing it, get to where you were in the room, hiring the writer, hiring the director, celebrating that you got a go picture. Everything's great. And okay, I'm out. Got it. Okay. So you were the farm team. And then it's like being driven to, like, you were part of the team that was going to the Super Bowl and everyone's getting on the bus. And then some guy you don't know just looks at you like, Fickman, is that with an F? No, I don't see you. Hey, buddy. Well, good. Thank you. And then the bus leaves and you're like, but I helped develop.
Right.
It didn't even, before it was called Playing with Fire, it was just called Fire. I came up with Playing with. I wrote your name on a list. And it bothered me because then you were out of it. And then if you did go visit the set, you were like the suit who like almost was like the equivalent of like a narc in high school.
Exactly. Like, your parents coming home. You're having a party and all of a sudden you look up and you're, oh, geez, the parents are
everybody,
here.
Like, right. Richard Mauser and like
I know that Risky feeling
Business,
well.
Yeah. Where you just are walking around and you're like, hello, everybody.
Yeah.
And then you get to post, and now you're trying to give notes, but you're not really a part of it. And then you get to the premiere, and you're kind of looking around, and something that was so important to you is no longer a part of your life. Mm-hmm. So I vowed, plain and simple, when I could get a chance, I would want to include people. And then two things happen. Again, Bob Greenblatt, all things point to Bob Greenblatt. That's why I have a website called ilovebobgreenblatt.com. I've got T-shirts for sale. If you love Bob Greenblatt or know anyone named Bob Greenblatt, I have a Robert Greenblatt hat, whatever. And this isn't – I know with Bob, if you're listening, again, I'm just – it's a lot of block calls I'm getting. And call me and we could just – I just need your email address. Bob, when I was off in Vancouver – back where it began, doing Reefer Madness, Bob wanted updates. And I would give Bob my nightly update. And Bob, I remember one day, said, oh, can you include so-and-so on the update distribution? I was like, well, not actually. I don't think it's distribution. I think I'm just telling you a funny thing that happened on set.
Right.
And that then became a really great opportunity that I realized was the communication was that. Mm-hmm. And for those who sort of don't know, the production report, the end of every night, you know, a production report is filed that more or less says what happened that day. And it's a very dry document. The first shot happened, you know, 1 hour and 8 minutes after we arrived. Andy Fickman was late. We did this. We didn't complete. And it's a horrible document to read in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say anything. It's not designed to be a positive cheerleader.
Oh, no, it's definitely not. It's only supposed to alert you if something bad happened.
Right. And
if
this is how much money
good, it's just so, this went fine.
And what I realized was early on, again, that if I could talk about the day kind of creatively and address the, hey, it was raining, we didn't get that shot, but we're going to pick it up on Thursday, I found that there was never any real overreaction to what was happening, and that, more importantly, everybody in LA was really a part of the process. Right. They began to know the inside jokes. They began to know the people.
Sorry to interrupt you. The everybody, like Dennis Habert, when he came on set, and the actors that are coming on set, the visual effects, when they come, they go, oh, I know all these people from the journal. So they are feeling like a part of it even before they're arriving. Or
I think that's a big thing, because we know – like sets, you don't, you know, in theater, we all have 6 weeks to rehearse a play together and all become kumbaya. In television, if you're on series, we're going to do this and it's a rhythm. Film, a lot of times it's you're in for 3 days, you're out, thanks. We want everyone to be a part of that. And our internal jokes, we want them to be the world. So that really became part of that. And I made the rule, which now I'm sort of stuck with, which was I would do it every night before I went to bed. Also, on a personal level, it was truly kind of my blog of like a great way to review, did I get everything that day and what didn't work? And then on the sizzle reels, and that field journal has become just my – people would talk about it. People would say, are you still going to do it? Are you still doing it? And I got to tell you, sometimes 4 o'clock in the morning – you know, when I get home and I want to sleep and I'm like, dear diary.
Exactly.
I hate it. Like, I'm just going to cut and bait. What did I say on game plan a few years back? That
They'll
sounds
know.
Good.
They'll never know.
Change the name. Still funny then. The sizzle reel was a similar thing, was that I found, like, you know, both as someone who's headed studios and as a producer, dailies are tricky. Because dailies out of context can become a – maybe the one shot you saw is the shot that goes, are you shooting daily? Are you shooting masters?
Yeah, exactly.
I have not seen a master. I'm worried you don't know how masters work.
Or they'll see something and think that would be the take you're going to use. And they'll say, you know, this thing in the background wasn't right. And like, I know, we're not using that shot for 1 second. It's hard for – if you're not here – to understand what the hell we're doing.
And
sometimes
to know that you already have, I have that line in a previous take. Right. The reason we did that next take was to get this look.
Just that piece, yeah.
But they don't have that. And, you know, it would be hard for them to have all that.
Yeah.
Sizzle reel then becomes a question of, to avoid people having tonal questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helps if you have been very blessed to have amazing editors and that they work with you as a partner. But I catalog every day shots that I want for the sizzle reel. And then we put it together and it's like a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a trailer of your last 2 weeks of filming. And it's a way to help everybody tonally go, oh, you got it. And you do sometimes put pieces together to say, this is the look you want, that's the look. And when we show it, what I've always loved is using, like, we carry it on the cart. It's at Video Village. Every time we have guests, even from the studio, and people want to get a sense of our movie, you show them 4 minutes of footage that's cut together, and they have a blast.
Yeah, and everybody does want to see it. Even just my friends that have visited are like, well, can you show this guy that? They don't even have anything to do with the movie.
I go home every night and just rewatch it, and I'm like, I think I did okay.
I did a good
job. Can I have another treat?
So we're more than halfway done with this movie. What has been your best day on set so far?
I think the day I realized that John Cena and I have very similar body types was the best day. Because I walked up to that, Todd, I had some self-doubt. But his shirt was off, and I took my shirt off. And that, I was like,
I was wondering why you did that, by the way.
A lot of people were. But I had my shirt off, and his shirt was off, and I was like, that feels right. I feel whatever he's doing, He must be eating the same sandwich as I'm eating. And this Nutella is nutritious. I would say one of the best days was early on when we had all of them together. And it was one of our bigger physical comedy days. But it was also a day where we were going to have all of our guys and all of our kids and Judy. And you realize this is – I got every personality in the movie. Mm-hmm. Is it now going to work together? Smoke jumpers are funny together. The kids are great together. Now you add Judy. Is it? And we were at Video Village laughing. And that stuff where we're so blessed with this cast where, you know, you say action to Keegan and you could literally like go home, take a shower, get a haircut, do some light shopping, come back. And he's still going.
Yeah, he's amazing.
And he's amazing. And that sense that you had picked right.
Yeah.
That was probably my favorite day. And then the second was anytime you have a speed bump, and every project has speed bumps. There's weather affects you anytime. Anytime you have a hard moment, it's how you recover as a cast and crew. Mm-hmm. And I think that where you and I have, we've been dealing with weather and all of our things, when we've hit a couple of speed bumps and we saw that cast and crew just take it and run with it, and you go, that's who I want to be in the trenches with. Yeah. Those are my favorites.
I'm very proud of this movie, just in terms of the way the cast is jived and the crew has just stepped up. Everybody's having a blast, and that's a big testament to you, my friend, and the way you run your sets.
I think you have to create – I think you and I, our goal always is you're doing a funny movie. Mm-hmm. You got to have a fun set.
Yeah.
People have to feel – Todd did this thing – I just said it like you were past – well, let's talk about it just in case. For all of those, Todd, I know earlier I made the comment about Kenny Rogers Roasters, and I feel bad. So Google a James Brolin and go, he's more James Brolin than Kenny Rogers, and I think we're all going to miss.
I'll take either, by the way.
We're all going to miss Todd. Let's just take a moment of silence. Todd early on said to the crew that, I don't think I've ever heard a producer say, this is right after he said, you will worship me, which was weird. And then he played like AC/DC in the background and the crew was like, we fear him. Todd announced everyone should pitch. No, like pitch your comedy, pitch your ideas. And I think the first day he announced it, like people were like, did he really mean that? And there was whispering. And then the next day, people start pitching. Yeah. And to this day, everybody in the crew pitches an idea.
Yeah.
And we take them. Like, yeah. There hasn't been a go away. It's been, that's great. Let's do that. And it's.
Listen, I know I said pitch, but this is becoming ridiculous.
What I meant was everyone is allowed to pay me for a pitching seminar. And Todd Garner, I have some information that. But that environment makes your crew, and they're. I mean, we're at Video Village, and people are just leaning over saying, what about that? Yeah. What if you try that? And you can't take them all. And just because you have a pitch doesn't make it gold.
Right.
Remember that, everybody coming to Hollywood.
Right.
Also, remember that, Andy Fickman. But the openness of saying, I want to hear it.
Yeah.
And I want to try it. And that's a big thing with comedy is you don't know.
No, like, you definitely do not.
You've said it time and time again. Writing comedy years ago, 6 months ago, not on set, not knowing what the rhythm was, not knowing the door turned left, not right. You write comedy in your head and be like, it'll be perfect. If they say it this way and they turn to the left, and if we have a cheddar cheese machine that I imagine looks like this, and then you get to set, there's no cheddar cheese machine, there is no left, and the actor is not going to say it the way you had imagined. You just got to be open to that and those pitches, because that is, if you don't try it, you won't know.
There's been many times on every movie, but you know, this movie's no exception, where I'll say, ooh, there's a whole hallway here I didn't, there's no way for that guy to come through the door and do that, because this set is not the way I had it in my head. There's a long 30-foot hallway we have to account for. So now listen to what I'm saying. Besides the Renaissance Fair,
Yes, my lord.
No, besides that, what would be your advice for people that are just listening to this that love theater, live in Midland, Texas? Just what would be your advice for somebody coming to town and wants
to... And just to clarify, besides the Renaissance Fest.
Besides, because I know you. I know exactly where you're going
to dig deep.
I know where you're going to go. What advice would you have for people?
It really, to me, is I think what defines me, I think what defines you, and almost everybody I know in Hollywood, with the exception of Mr. Bob Greenblatt, who's one of the most wonderful people in the world. Again, please follow me on my new podcast. I love Bob Greenblatt. Again, Bob, just a phone call or an email exchange would be nice. I'm still in the book. Check me in the creative directory. I was issue number 17. Issue number 17, creative directory. The greatest thing, I'm looking at this equipment you have in front of you. The greatest thing, that did not sound great.
Thank you, Andy.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm going to, okay. This paid for all the mechanical equipment.
Yeah, the podcast equipment.
You producing is truly making something out of nothing. Directing is creating something that wasn't there a moment ago. Writing is a blank page. Create. You have more tools now. I'm so jealous. My son's a student at USC, and I'm so jealous of him having a dad like me willing to pay for USC. That's awesome. And how much he suckers me for everything. That's great. He is a smart kid. I love you, Austin. The tools that everybody has now are, if you look at the success of YouTube, you look at it, create. I don't care where you are in the world. If I was just starting now, I would take my iPhone. I would write a script. I would go film something funny. I could have it online at the end of the day.
Right.
And then you can start learning if you're a storyteller. And then you could start finding, so you want to produce something? Well, I found somebody, and what we need to do is raise $400. When we started our theater company, Fountainhead Theater Company, which was really helped launch by the genius Andrew Schaefer, and we sort of put it together. We did a garage sale every week in LA. We were all assistants or waiters. And we would do a garage sale because we needed to raise a couple $1,000 to put on a new play.
Wow.
Every week we would be on someone's front yard selling everything. Ridiculously, every week I was the guy buying all the crap. I'd be like, and Red Bull cans, these are going to be worth something someday.
And you're going the wrong way.
Back to the opening hoarding episode. Mm-hmm, where did you get all this? Well, I bought it at my own garage sale. I'd have so much stuff. I was like, this looks like a fantastic chair I would want. I'm selling it? Okay. But we would raise money to put on a show.
Right.
And that classic from the beginning of time, let's get my uncle's barn and put on a show, hasn't changed. The distribution abilities now are endless. You can show somebody your ability to produce, write, and direct from anywhere in the world. And I don't think it's an argument anymore to be able to say, oh, I don't have exposure
don't
to
have
it,
access,
or I can't
right.
be seen.
Yep.
I don't have access. Every day on set, Todd will lean over and show me a video of something that makes him laugh. Weirdly enough, it's just things Todd has done. It's old photos. It's all skits. Todd goes home in his hotel room and does skits and is like, look what I discovered on YouTube last night.
None of this is true.
So true. But that's your chance. What's fearful for people, and you and I know this across the board in Hollywood, we know everybody in town who is like, I'm currently working on a script. They'll never finish it. Because it's safer in their mind than it is when you read it. Person who's, I'm really close to producing this big movie that's never going to happen because they're not nearly as close as they are. Person who's getting ready to direct my first feature and they're not prepared or it's not going to happen. But if you took that same energy and put your show on and all of a sudden was like, I spent $100 and put it on YouTube and I got my four best friends and we wrote it and I got some actor friends and... That's the challenge, is you have to start somewhere. And that would be the best advice, I think. And the second part of that, which I'm adamant about, watch movies and watch television and see theater and read. It drives me crazy when I bring up a reference to a movie. If I mention Animal House and I find out I'm working with you and you haven't seen it, but you want to be a writer, director, producer, If I go to a doctor and they're a general practitioner and my arm is broken, I don't want the doctor to be like, I am not familiar with that. You don't have to be a specialist.
Right.
I just want you to look at it and be like, huh, broken arm. Let me tell you what we're going to do.
Yeah.
If I'm meeting with a young writer or director, or producer, and there's sometimes that little bit like, I'm a little too cool for school. I don't see movies. It used to be the old joke of I don't see movies in black and white. You know, I only see movies from the year I remember watching movies. Oh, now you're you don't have to go to Blockbuster. You don't have to rent it. It is all on your computer. And if you are not getting caught up on movies, not getting caught up on television, not reading or seeing theater, it's sad to me because I don't know how to communicate with you in the future that you don't know the same references. And our history from the beginning of filmmaking, and even if you just want to say, I'm going to start watching it from the late 1920s and, on, just watch and watch world cinema and all of that, which you said we would go to Blockbuster. You check out movies and then you had to go take them back, get the next lot. Now it's just so available. And that I think is what prepares somebody to come to our town.
Great. Well, you can tell that I have a great deal of affection for you. I love you. And I've been so...
Todd, when you say you love me, is this like an actual... is it a Hollywood love or is it like a real...
Is it real deep?
Because I'll be honest, I am about 20 grand in the hole. And a good love is that doesn't ask many questions and would provide me with what I would consider like a bridge float film financing of my life type thing.
Perfect.
It's just 20 grand. Also, I need you to write it out to an Andy Fletcher. I'll explain it off camera. It's all better that it doesn't come to me directly.
Well, this has been very fun. Thank you for doing this, brother. In the middle of our shoot, thank you for doing
this. Can I say, Todd knows this. It truly is my favorite podcast is listening to Todd, but it's also nice because I feel like somebody else has him for an hour and then I'm like, well, he's not calling me during this time period. So that's also nice. But this is one of my favorite podcasts. Thanks. And when you told me I was going to be on it, I legit got excited and also took care of the part where I kept thinking like, what if he doesn't ask me? What if I'm never asked? And then every week I'm like, I love your podcast.
And I'm just standing
next to you
every day.
It's so great that you're talking to people in the actual industry. If only I had a movie with you.
Well, thank you, buddy. I appreciate it.
Thanks,
you're the best. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use #producersguide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. New to Podcast One, Two Cups of Joe. Singer and actor Joey Fatone, joined by his manager and friend of 25 years, Joe Mulvihill, will be discussing everything from parenting and raising a family to TV, film, music, and sports with some of their famous friends. From his time in NSYNC to film roles like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, hosting TV shows, and performing on Broadway, Fatone brings his unique viewpoint of the entertainment industry. Combined with Mulvihill's access to the business, you're sure in for some fun.
Hey, what's up? It's Joey Fatone.
And this is Joe Mulvihill. Check us out on PodcastOne.com and Apple Podcasts. Both venues. If you have an Android, it's PodcastOne.com. And if it's an Apple, it's Apple Podcasts. Oh, you sound like Scooby-Doo.
I didn't know that.